Major Hon, Rule 53. What was the internal security situation like in the vicinity of the Orchard Camp?
Within, we had the 10 sentries.
Mm. But I'm talking about the level of threat generally in the area.
We didn't expect any threat from the Arab side. We expected the threat from the Israelis.
How did you get that idea then? Did you have intelligence briefings from some headquarters?
Knowing the things that have been going on in Jerusalem with the terrorists, which appeared mainly to be Jewish. And we thought, as we were an Arab unit as such, we had no fear of attack from them at all. So it was just an assumption, really. It was nothing to go on. But that we thought, well, the only people who are likely to attack this camp
would be the Zionists.
Yes, but not Arabs. And so we didn't have a great deal of concern. Security, the guards were on. We had the guard room by the main gate. We always used to have an NCO of the guard. We always used to have an officer. One of us would go every day or every evening and check.
A duty officer.
The Palestine police officer didn't take part. It was just the three of us, really. It was a case of he had nothing else to do anyway. And it's rather ironic, really, because one day, in November time, November, early December, one of the Arab officers came to me and said, would I referee a football match between two companies of the Arabs, you see? So, I didn't know the first thing about football. I didn't know anything about refereeing or anything like that. And I said, well, if you want me to, I will. I'll do my best. But say I don't know a lot about it, but I'll do it. So I said, yes, thank you very much. So, this particular afternoon, off I went and sort of started the match. And we were playing football. Then at half time, I was carried off.
What had happened?
My knee had gone.
Ah.
Completely. I don't know if I mentioned it, but certainly when we were in Ride area, I had a Beaveret car turned over.
Yes, I think you mentioned that on your leg, yes.
And I did nothing about it. Mm. And over the period of time, certainly after I'd left Sandhurst, when I was at Sandhurst, it was great. I could run, I could do all these sort of things. But later, all the muscle in the thigh started to wither away. There was nowhere near the muscle in that leg as there was that one.
So your right leg was withering above the knee?
That's right. And there was no muscle there, and I couldn't bend my knee very well. I used to sit for comfort with it out straight, but I didn't go to the hospital or do anything about it.
Why was that? Why didn't you seek medical advice?
Well, I don't know. I've always been the same. I'm afraid of medical, but I think, why waste the time? I can manage all that. And so, and got away with it. But on this occasion, that I couldn't walk unless somebody went. So they carried me off the field, and the ambulance ambulance took me into Beer Yakov Hospital. And when they examined me, they said, oh, we'll operate on you. The ligaments, or the tissues, I think more like the cartilages had gone in the leg. So, and the muscles were weak. So they put me in bed, and they got halfway on the next day, you see. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, there was a bit of commotion, and they brought in a young guards officer on a stretcher and put him in the bed next to me. So I woke up, I said, oh, what's happened to you? He said, oh, I've been shot in the bottom. He said, I said, where was this? He said, just outside Ramleh. He said, the Arabs had complained that the Jews were attacking them at night, and they wanted an outpost put out on the road, you know, to sort of stop anything.
What, a sort of roadblock?
A roadblock, see. So he said, no, I was in charge of it. So I said, well, what happened then? He said, well, they attacked the Arab police training depot last night. And the leading vehicle came into our roadblock as they came back from it. And what had happened, apparently, wasn't attacked by the Zionists. It was all done from an inside job with the sergeant, the guard commander. He went round every sentry, relieved him, put one of his own gang there. So every sentry around was armed, but they weren't loyalists. And then he looked at all these other sentries in the guard room. The second lieutenant walked down to see what was going on, and they took him and they locked him away. The commanding officer was out at the time. I don't know where he'd gone, but he certainly wasn't in the camp. And then they calmly loaded up the unit transport with all the rifles, all the same guns, and 3 lorry loads of ammunition, and drove out of the camp. And of course, the leading vehicle with the sergeant on board and one or two of the others who were all in on it bumped the roadblock because there was a bit of a fire. That sergeant who was organised, one of the organised, was killed, and 2 or 3 of the others. So they got the leading vehicle, but the other 2, or whatever number there was, and more than 2, turned around and disappeared.
So the ammunition went?
Everything. Mm. The leading lorry, I'm not sure what it had on it, but that was recovered. So, had I been there and seen this happen, I would obviously have got into my little trench with my gun and could have done something, hoping that all the people around me were there, but they wouldn't have been. I mean, I could have then had a knife in my back.
Yes, indeed.
From these people, without giving a thought. Mm. So, that's what happened, actually.
You had a narrow escape, possibly.
Yeah. And the officer who's commanding told me that it was sheer luck that this had happened on the day, and they operated on me that day. And I stayed in hospital at Beer Yakov for a few weeks. And then they transported me to the hospital in Egypt, just on the canal zone. I get the name of it now. It's in another hospital there. And of course, all the muscles are gone. Mm. And then after a while there, they shipped me back to on a hospital ship back to England. Mm. And I've always a funny story when I was in the one at Egypt, and the man who told me was one of the consultants who was on a board of inquiry, which took place in the hospital. Apparently, King Farouk has had an accident just outside this hospital, and he was brought into the hospital, you know, for to be tended and
looked after.
And at a board of inquiry, they had a private out of RSC who was driving the lorry that Farouk had hit. And he gave his evidence, apparently. He said, I was driving on the road, and along came a sports car going very fast, and it hit me, and it rolled over. And when I got back to it, it was upside down in the ditch. The wheels were still going round, and inside it were a couple of logs. So the president of the board said, look, you can't refer to the King of Egypt as a log. So rephrase your evidence. Blah, 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 blah. And when I got to the car, there it was, upside down, but the wheels still going round. And inside it was the King of Egypt and another one. And he said, that's perfectly true, that was, you know. So, from that hospital, as I say, I got on the...
Did you have any treatment there?
Well, I was doing physiotherapy, and they didn't do any more operation, but they were doing physiotherapy.
Did that seem to be working to you?
It got me so I could walk.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to be doing anything for my leg.
Mm.
You know, the muscle. The muscles were...
Still withered.
Mm. Mm. So, probably over a period of time, you see, that had me sort of being too concerned about it. And so, very unfortunate then, I came back to Southampton on the hospital ship. And then they took me out to Chester and kept me there a couple of nights. And they said, well, there's nothing else we can do for you. And they sent me down to the Royal Herbert at Woolwich. Mm. And I was there and doing physiotherapy. And in the end, they downgraded me.
What does that mean? What are the implications of being downgraded?
Well, I was no longer fit for the army.
Oh. How was that done? Did you have?
Well, they did the board and examinations in the hospital.
Mm.
Seeing their recommendations go, and they give you tests of what you can do, and they said, right, well, and of course they weren't short of officers or anything then. So I was told I would leave the army. And I wasn't on a regular commission anyway. I don't know if they'd just started regular commissions then. But there was no... they said they'd give me a small pension.
What sort of commission did you have? Was it an emergency commission?
Well, I think they were emergency then. I don't think they got on to short service then, quite honestly.
Mm.
Yes, they had, it was short service.
Short service.
Short service, yeah. And so I left the army then, and well, what am I going to do? So I went to work in trust houses, in their head office in Shorts Gardens, Covent Garden, Holborn.
Yes. Did you have no resettlement training or anything of that sort before leaving?
No, nothing.
How long did the process of being assessed and downgraded and discharged take then altogether?
Couple of months.
So you didn't have much time to think about what to do.
No, I just sort of went, and of course, I went to the head office at Shorts Gardens and worked there. And the job I had was to buy all the cigars and cigarettes for all the trust houses in England.
How did you actually get that job? Did you, was it an answer to an advertisement or some other way?
I didn't know whether it was an advertisement or... I went to the officer's job, they had a sort of centre where you could go and sort of say...
Was this run by the army?
Run by the army. And this was came up, and I thought, well, I don't want to try it, and it's Jesse. And my job was to get all the stock books of each hotel. And they had quite a number in England, all over England, didn't they?
One of the major chains.
It was. And I'd look at the books and say, oh, well, with that type of hotel, you need Corona cigars, or you need cheroots, or you need this, that, and that. And so we've ready?
Yeah.
Say, right, get in touch with the different companies and say, send so many cigars of a certain type to Brown's Hotel in London, and for the one in Aldgate, send some cheroots or whatever. And that was my job, to make sure that all these different hotels were supplied with either the cigar or cigarettes that would suit their clientele. And I used to have travellers come from different companies who'd say, just come back from Cuba, and sort of tell me all about the cigars, how they're made, and what they're like, and give me a couple, and say, you taste
the sample.
Yeah, and see what it's like. And so, and then another man would come in, and I would use that knowledge on him. And so I built up quite a knowledge of cigars. And yet I've never smoked in my life. And same with cigarettes. And so that's what I did. But I found that I could do that job. A month's work I could do in a fortnight or a week. And I used to be pulled out of the skull.
I was going to ask you how you adjusted to this sudden transition to civilian life.
To the different cigarette factories.
Yes.
And see what they were doing. But I was bored. Nothing I could do. And so in the end, I decided on another career.
How long did you stick at it then, as a buyer for Trust for Trust House?
3 years, perhaps, I think.
Yeah. Did the company treat you well? Generally?
Yes, you could have your meals in one of the hotels. I mean, I used to go to Brown's Hotel in London, which was a magnificent hotel, occasionally visit and have a nice meal. And they treated me well, but as I say, it was boring, and I couldn't see where I was leading anyway.
You didn't think you were cut out for management? In
well,
that sense.
And that sort of thing would be pretty tedious, and you could look around and see people who've been there for years, and it's the same old sort of see the cobwebs sort of hanging from their ears and that sort of thing. It didn't appeal to me at all. Nothing adventurous.
What did you decide to do then once you had got fed up with working for trust houses?
Well, I saw an advertisement for a partner in a farm in Cornwall. And I always liked the land and animals and that. And, so I got in touch with the man, the farmer, and went down one weekend, beautiful summer's day. They were hay making. There was this farmer and his wife. And so I spent the weekend hay making, and we were up on the high ground. You could see the Atlantic from the farm in Lundy. So it was really, couldn't have been more attractive.
North coast of Cornwall.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I telephoned straight away. Jane said, yes, I'll come in, and wrote him a cheque, about £250. As a sign of goodwill that I would come, and said I would come down about a fortnight's time. So, duly at, I arrived at Ottram Station, and he was there to meet me. And I had my wife with me, Pam, who had been married all that long. And we got off the train. And as soon as she saw him, He said to me, I don't trust him. He didn't like him from the start, and he knew it. But by then, I'd committed, I think, altogether £2,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And I also borrowed £500 from my solicitor in Launceston at 10%, which was again a lot of money. But I didn't mind, I thought, well, the future was going to be good. Yeah. He said what we would do, we would work together as partners, build up enough money, and then we would then take another farm, one would work on one the other, which sounded very good. And I was quite prepared to work. Mm. In fact, I did. I used to work from 6 in the morning, go out and do all the milking. But he was an expert on tractors. He could pull a tractor to pieces and put it together, and he was brilliant on that side.
On the machinery.
On machinery and driving the tractor, do the farm work. I would do all the cattle, the milking, and maintaining the buildings and all the general hard work, like knocking out the cow sheds and various buildings and whatnot, and going around checking sheep, and seemed to be going quite well.
What was it, a mixed farm?
Yes. Mm. We had sheep, we had cows, we had a couple of pigs and that sort of thing. Mm. And so I said, I used to work very, very hard. And we also took out an insurance for £3,000 on each other's lives. Mm. So that if anything happened to one, the money from that
would go to the other.
Into the farm, you see. So this was going quite well. And he did all the books.
Oh.
I never saw the books. Mm. He used to, but I trusted again, it was stupid.
I mean, had your agreement with him been put in writing when you took up the
solicitor?
Yes.
And the thing was, if either of us wanted to withdraw, we'd have to give 6 months' notice. Mm. So things were going along, and one day I happened to see a bill for a load of cow cake, pig food, chicken food. Quite a big consignment of food and cattle.
Mm.
And we used to have a Chev lorry, the ex-army thing, which we used to use for on the farm, going down to the station and getting cow food or whatever, general purpose of a big lorry, 3-ton thing. They were 3-ton when they stretched. And I saw this bill, and I thought, well, we haven't had this, you see, and I tackled about it, and he was a bit evasive. And I later discovered that he was going, ordering all this stuff, going down to the railway station, getting it off the truck and whatnot, putting it onto the line, and driving it out and selling it to another farm.
Uh-huh.
And putting the cash into his own pocket. So, well, this is.
He was misusing your capital then.
He was,
That's fraud, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a strict sense, fraudulent conversion.
Was, yeah.
Mm.
So I said, all right, we'll terminate the partnership. And I gave a notice to the solicitor, you know, that we would terminate. But we still had to work out the
6 months.
6 months. And so the atmosphere wasn't very good.
Can you imagine?
I moved out of the farmhouse because at first I shared the farmhouse and we got a cottage down in Tintagel.
Mm.
And so I used to have to commute up to the farm and I had to do it on a bicycle, which was about 7 or 8 miles.
Mm.
It was hard work up a very steep hill from sea level, 900 feet.
Mm.
And so, but as I say, I carry on with my job at work. And then one day we were cleaning out the cow shed, We had the lorry backed up within 2 foot of where the entrance opened, leading to the big, thick Cornish walls.
Yeah.
The cow shed and very narrow doorway.
Yes.
And I'd thrown all the muck out from the shed to just outside and just allowed a couple of feet. And I was throwing it onto the back of the lorry to take it out into the field, you see. And he said, oh, well, I'll just move the lorry forward. So I said, okay. And I carried on working. And suddenly the vehicle shot back. And my instincts were so fast, and I got flat, and the tailboard of the lorry, the shed, just rolled over me, and the lorry was crushed up against the wall. Now, that was a deliberate effort to kill me, because a shed lorry, before you could get it into reverse on the gear stick, there was a little catch that you had to lift up.
Yep, safety catch.
Yeah, you lift it up and then put it into the gate back. And so there was no way that he could have done this by mistake. So I crawled out from under, and that lorry still stood there. And I crawled out from underneath, he was still sitting in the driver's seat. See? Very quiet, you know, I crawled up. I still had my fork that I'd been building up, and I pushed it into his stomach. And I never lose my temper. Well, I'm very calm. I was absolutely livid, white with anger. And I put that in his stomach. I said, for two things, I'll push this straight through you, because that was a deliberate attempt to kill me. Yeah, and I can understand how a man would commit a murder, and in that circumstance, because it was so obvious what he was going to do, because he had the insurance which would come to him anyway. And I said, I'm going home now. I said, I'm then going to see my solicitor. I'm going to tell him exactly what's happened. I said, so if anything happens to me, and now, and when our partnership ends, that'll be recorded. So I went home and I said to my wife, I said, I'm going to kill him. And she was in tears. She said, I will suffer, you will suffer. He's not worth it. But I was still thinking, how can I kill him? And I've never had this sort of thing to want to harm anybody ever before, even the war.
Well, this is a personal matter, isn't it?
It was. That was so deliberate. And to think that all my trust, you know, was sort of betrayed like this. What could I do? And I brooded over this for ages. And in the end, I had sort of crying all the time. So, you know, don't be stupid. So I just carried on until the time that we could leave.
Did you go and see your solicitor? And
well, I told him.
What did he say?
Well, he just said, oh, I'm going to record. Is there anything else you want me to do about it? I said, no point. You know, it'd be his word against mine, if anything.
But, I mean, you might have had him for fraud because he'd been misusing the...
Yes, but then again, I didn't get the books. I didn't have the books.
No, but I mean...
Take a little bit for me to prove a bit. In any case, all I wanted was to get out.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. I wasn't sort of wanting him to go to prison or anything, because his wife was the nicest person. He had married her. His first wife had died. And this girl had been land girl on his farm at Luton. Same place, but she had married him, and she had about 4 children, not her children, but his children. So, you know, she was a nice sort of person, and I don't think she cared for him a lot, because he used to be very cruel to her and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to get away. So when it came to the end, I said, okay, and I left the farm, and I rented the farm.
What happened to your half of the capital?
I'll come to that. about 75 acres I rented, actually, and moved into this little farmhouse, and then I borrowed money to stock it, and sort of waiting, you know, for the money to come through. And, I was waiting 3 or 4 months